Good morning, everyone. We are studying the teachings and the role of Jesus as a teacher. And we're into the part of the study where we're sampling different parts of Jesus' teachings. And this is, when I decided to do it this way, I thought, okay, this sort of makes sense. And then after last week's class, I'm like, oh, I'm glad we're doing it that way. Because, you know, the blind pig finds an acorn. Sometimes you don't know what you're doing and you sort of stumble on something. So I think this is a real profitable way to understand Jesus as a teacher, is just wade in and sample his teachings rather than trying to categorize it all or something like that. So very glad that you can be part of the study. Les, would you lead us in a prayer as we start?
Dear Lord, we're so grateful once again that we have this time to gather together as your saints, your children, and be a flock of your shepherding. And we appreciate the preparations that have been made to study your word, and pray that it's useful to us and that we've learned more about Jesus as a teacher and learned what he taught, along with the reality of his miracles that makes all of his teaching valid. Thank you for the love and mercy that you've shown to us and bringing us the measure of prosperity that we can all assemble here this morning. And I pray that you'd be with all the classes in Jesus' name. Amen.
Would you call Jesus' teachings complex? As in to understand. Why do you say no so quick? You're very adamant about that, Vince.
Yeah,
so back it up.
I know there are some things like the sower of the seed, you know, and his disciples asked him about that. Mm. Well, what does this mean? What does this parable mean? But really, his teaching to me was very simple. It was very relatable. Mm. Now, whether they got the spiritual message or not, or the understanding of what Jesus was trying to teach them, It really depended on the individual, and their background, and their level of interest, you might say, because it looks like the Pharisees wanted one thing, but yet the common people were just looking for something else.
Right. I think saying there, as you did, his teaching is relatable. The question was whether they got the spiritual message behind it or not. I think that's a great way to look at that, because the basic words he used and examples, illustrations, analogies, as we looked at last week, analogies, and we'll look at illustrations today, they're really understandable. They're not complex, but yet there are deep meanings. So that's my next question. I sort of gave it away. Though his teaching is not complex, is it deep? Would you say it was deep?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
In what ways does it have depth?
I think it got to the very root of people's, I guess what it's, I think it's given to people to acknowledge God. I think, you know, every nation, they yearn to worship something bigger than themselves. But it gets to the root of who we are, what how we look at life. How we experience life.
Okay. So the spiritual depths and what's going on inside the thinking of people and the thoughts and so forth, there's depth to that. And so he's addressing the grandest themes ever. He's addressing God. The idea of God is the biggest idea ever, right? And he's addressing things such as the human soul and salvation and sin and eternity. So he's dealing with the deepest things, but he's using the most common things to teach those things. So we'll see more of that as we go in. So two things we want to attempt today. We looked at how Jesus taught, like with analogies last time, so we are sort of categorizing his different approaches in teaching. Look at this next category. We're going to start with Luke chapter 12, spiritual lessons from life stories. And by life stories, I mean, he tells the story about somebody who actually lived, or close to that. Now, Let me say this about parables before we get into Luke 12. So go over to Luke 12, verse 13, and we'll start there in just a moment. But let me say this about parables. Here in a couple of weeks, we're going to dive into what a parable is. I know you've had a class on that not too long ago, about 3 years ago or something like that. But we're going to sample the parables, and I want to more fully define them then. Typically, what a parable does is tell a very basic, common story. Something like a farmer does, sowing seed, or someone planting and harvesting a vineyard, or a shepherd who has a flock and things he does with the flock. Very common, a woman cleaning her house. Very common things. It's like us talking about someone operating a computer or driving a car. Something very, very common. Washing clothes with a clothes washer, okay, a washing machine. And so you just tell that story, but when he tells that story, you know he's got some kind of spiritual message there, and then in the parable, you're challenged to find that. So we're going to talk about parables later. However, he actually gives them a parable in this text that Luke says he told them a parable, and I would say that this is the kind of parable that's a little bit different than the normal ones in the way he approaches it, but we're going to talk about parables officially later, and though this is dubbed a parable, I want you to see that it's not just a common story about doing an everyday thing, like trading for goods, like a merchant. Baked into the story, in this story, is a very plain, direct, pertinent spiritual message. So let's look at this first of all. Luke chapter 12, 13 to 21. Rachel Messer, can you read those verses, please, for us?
Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter over you?" And he said to them, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life..." Consist of his possessions. And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a certain rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops?' And he said, 'That is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'"
All right, thank you. Now, I want you to look at the dialogue here. There's a story in the middle of this, but it's framed in a dialogue. So carefully look at this. Verse 13, how does the dialogue start?
Well, someone's asking him to be, tell my brother to divide the inheritance,
right,
possessions among me.
Someone in the crowd or from the crowd. So here you have a crowd of people that Jesus is teaching, and one individual, a man, speaks up from the crowd and asks Jesus to be a financial arbitrator between him and his brother. Two things Jesus didn't wade in on: that kind of business and politics. Didn't do it. He's got bigger fish to fry. He's got more important things to deal with. And he refuses to do that here. And who's to know whether maybe he had been cheated by his brother? Maybe he cheated his brother. Who knows the situation? Maybe it's just a common misunderstanding and no wrong done here. But Jesus is not going to do that. In verse 14, what's the next step in the dialogue?
Well, he says, "Who appointed me as judge or arbiter over me?"
Isn't that an interesting comment Jesus makes here? Because ultimately, who is Jesus?
The ultimate judge.
He is the judge of all time, of all people. But it's in this kind of situation, he's not going to judge in that. And it has to do with this idea that this is really not important. As the thing unfolds, you see why. And then something happens in this dialogue. One individual asks Jesus this question. Then Jesus responds to him and says, "I'm not going to arbitrate in this." And then in verse 15, what happens? What happens in the dialogue?
Gives him a warning.
And who?
Well, he says, you know, beware, be on your guard against these things.
Who does he give a warning to?
Everyone.
Everybody. He said to them, which would have included this man, but it includes everybody in that crowd. He said to them. So he takes this conversation that starts between him and this man, and he enlarges it because everybody's overhearing it. He enlarges it to teach a lesson to everybody there. It's what you could call a teaching moment. This one man has this question, and he wants to isolate Jesus' attention, and Jesus takes this situation and uses it as a teaching moment. So, especially when it comes to parables, but in many cases, Jesus will, I'm going to use this word, shroud his teaching a little bit. He cloaks it a little bit to get the listener to lean in. It's like Vince was talking about a while ago. So he tells this story about a vineyard, or he tells this story about a shepherd and a flock. What does he mean by that? Jesus wants people to either to lean in and wonder and question and probe, sort of like the Beatitudes, hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Do they really want to know or not? Or somebody hears a story and they're like, whatever, I don't know what he's talking about. And they lean out, they walk away. We'll talk about that when we get to the parables. That's really the purpose of the parables. Many times, not just in parables, but in a lot of things, Jesus will say something and people will scratch their head. Like, what is he getting at? After the miracle of feeding the 5,000, in John 6, Jesus does extensive teaching about the bread of life. And it starts off a little bit vague, and people are struggling with it, and that's on purpose. This is not that occasion. Before he even tells the parable, before he even gives the story that illustrates his point, what does he say? In verse 15.
Where?
Take care, beware, what? Life's not about your possessions. Okay, which is about covetousness. You're exactly right. Before he even tells the story, he gives the lesson. He gives the meaning of the story. Life's not about your possessions. So see how that dialogue goes. That this is a teaching situation. Jesus is so unique. We know that Jesus knows what's on the hearts of people before they even speak. Jesus knows what's going to happen ahead of time. He sees Nathanael under the tree before he even comes and talks to him in the Gospel of John. He knows exactly what Judas is going to do before Judas betrays him as part of his miraculous knowledge, his deity, all these kinds of things. But watch how Jesus will take a situation that unfolds. This person says this. This person says that. This event happens. This steps into the scene. And Jesus takes that and uses it masterfully to teach something. Jesus didn't prompt this man to ask the question or to ask him to be an arbitrator. So Jesus seizes that moment, but knowing what Jesus knows exactly what's going to unfold in every situation. So in that way, he's even a greater master of that than anybody could ever be apart from him. So in light of so what's the basic story that he tells? The unnamed farmer. There's a farmer. What happens to the farmer? Something happens to him. He does well. He has great harvests. So what does he decide to do?
Store it up.
Store it up. Save it up for himself. You know, barns, okay? Build bigger barns kind of thing. What unexpected thing happens to him? He dies that very night. And then look how Jesus bookends. He bookends the story with saying, first of all, be aware, take heed. Life doesn't consist of your possessions. And then he bookends it with what statement in verse 21?
Laying up your treasure.
Right.
Rich toward God.
So is someone who lays up treasure for himself, the man who built the bigger barns because he has the greatest harvest, and is not rich toward God. So that's how he bookends that. So in light of verse 21, what This is a simple story about a farmer who has an abundant harvest and he builds bigger barns, which on the surface doesn't look to be unusual behavior. But Jesus is teaching in this parable, in light of verse 21, what was the true condition of this farmer? He was a man who was what?
Rich anyway.
He was receiving abundance and was gaining wealth there.
Self-centered?
But he was self-centered. What was he concerned about mostly?
Accumulating.
Is what?
Accumulating.
His accumulating of physical earthly goods. But he was not a man who what?
Shared.
Evidently not a sharer. And what does he say in verse 21 about him? It's because he had that quality because he was not, in verse 21. Not rich toward God. What do you think that means, not rich toward God?
Thankful, grateful.
Okay. Certainly he's blessed by God with these things. Yeah. Jesus uses this expression in the lesson on the Mount, Matthew 6, where he talks about don't lay up for yourself or don't store for yourself treasure on earth, or moth, rust, thieves, take that away, but lay up your treasure in heaven. So what does it mean to lay up treasure in heaven, or in this case, be rich toward God? That's a similar expression. You're investing in God. You're putting your putting your assets in God. What would that involve? Vince, you mentioned gratitude, recognizing that God has blessed us. That's a great start. And oftentimes it's pointed out in this story, the man says, look, I have many goods. There's no God in there. It's I this, I got this, I have this, I will build this, etc.
Then not using what God blesses you with for to help others or for Him.
I think that's a clear thing there. When you look at what did he do wrong? He built the barns. Is that just wise investment? But when you let this thing play out and Jesus talks about he's not rich toward God, he could have been using some of those resources for other things. And so Jesus is describing a man who is material in his focus, a man who was not spiritual in his focus. And his life ended, and he was without God. Yeah, Ken?
He was only focused on what he wanted to do with his riches and not what God wanted him to do with them.
Right. God is not a factor with him. That's the factor with him. And, you know, being rich toward God, I mean, have you ever known someone who had basic clothes, a simple house, limited physical means, but they were nasty, stinking, filthy rich toward God? They were spiritual. They were godly. They were righteous. They lived to go to heaven. Their life was guided by God's teaching. You know, they don't have much when it comes to earthly goods, but they are rich. They're billionaires when it comes to spiritual treasure. And then this man's the opposite. He's prospering, but he's not the godly man. So that's what Jesus is teaching here. So in light of him giving this teaching, how do you think Jesus had assessed this man who approached him in verse 13?
Well, obviously he did have a form of greed because he's, you know, talking about inheritance. And I know in that time that was really important.
Mm. Right.
Yeah, you tell his mind was on the physical.
Right. Right. Could it be said that there's a good chance that he valued the inheritance more than his own brother? I mean, yeah.
The prodigal son is a good example.
It really is like the prodigal son, that the prodigal son was more concerned about his inheritance than his father.
But his brother also.
His brother was jealous, yes, of the things that he was receiving with the celebration reception. And all that too. You have a little bit of that in both of them. But Jesus is not giving this teaching in a vacuum. Well, let's see, what would I talk? I'm going to talk about greed and covetousness not being rich toward God. That's not arbitrary here. That teaching is coming out, because of the situation that is prompted by a man who's got the problem. Put it that way. He's got the problem. And the problem is materialism. The problem is not being rich toward God. The problem is thinking your life consists of the abundance of your possessions. So he reads that. So why is this story, given that situation, given that setting, given this man in verse 13 that asked as Jesus to be an arbitrator, why is the story so poignant?
It affects everybody. I mean, I'm not saying everyone's greed, but I think to a certain point we do look at things that we can purchase or have an inheritance or have possessions. I mean, we do, but some to a different degree, you know, a greater degree than others. So I think it affects everybody. We all, that's why he says, you know, be warned about gaining possessions for that sole purpose.
Now, you mentioned something here, Vince, at the beginning when you said it's something we all need, okay? Isn't it interesting how Jesus doesn't direct his teaching just toward this man? We've concluded from this text that this man and his attitude had a lot to do with why Jesus taught what he taught here. But he's not just teaching this man. He said to them, which means there is a great need for this lesson on the part of all of us. And when you look at verse 15 about being on guard, whenever the Bible uses expressions like be aware, be on guard, and this is common in Jesus' teaching, we should really take note and we should think to ourselves, oh, this must be a real common, relevant, critical issue. And it is. This is not just something that a few people have a problem with. Usually when you encounter an expression like that, be on guard. Against covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. It is so easy for us to think that our peace and happiness is in things. If I just had a few more things, or a few better things, or the next upgrade, okay? I had my phone stolen last week out of my car, okay? And I was over in Tennessee. And I was like, oh no, I got to get a new phone. I don't want to go in there and get the latest iPhone 929 or whatever it is. I wish I could go back in phones, okay? That's what I want. I want it simple, okay? But it is so, and it all worked out fine. I had insurance and I got a replacement. But it's so easy to think the next best, latest thing is going to bring me something I don't have that I need. So easy to think that. And you have to really fight that. Now, I'm not tempted on a phone, but there would be some other things I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't mind having a new or this or that, okay? But sometimes we have to get something new. Like when you need one, okay? It's different when you think, this will somehow make my life more abundant. And so this is such a universal thing. And look how Jesus teaches it. What else makes this story so poignant? It's universal, like Vince was talking about. What else is poignant about the story? Is it like a mild story? What kind of ending does it have? Death. He died that night. It has a very hard ending. It has almost like a scary ending. I mean, it's that night his soul was required of him. Yeah,
it was the night that he said it, not after he did it.
Yeah, it's all compact when he's making his plans, and he says, and this is where this is evidence that he's concerned about his own enjoyment. So you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. It's self-focused, isn't it? And that night, it's all very compressed. Yes. Is there another pen I saw? Okay. So it's really, really, it's very pointed here. Yes, Rich.
It also, I think an underlying thing that I see is it reminds me of, you know, kids, and they want what's fair to them.
Yeah.
And they're very concerned with everything being even and everybody getting exactly what's due to them. And I kind of see that this person is also very concerned mm-hmm. with justice and mm-hmm. what's fair to them.
Mm-hmm. Boy, he really cloaks this in, help me get what's fair to me. And Jesus peels that back. And he gives a lesson about covetousness, thinking your life is in goods, and not being rich toward God. Jesus doesn't fall for that. And he sees that this man has a deeper problem. And gives that. Yeah, Joe?
And as far as plans go, it's like in James where he says, if the Lord is willing, we'll do this and that.
Yeah. Look how God is taken out of the picture. God is not given the credit for the harvest, and God's not in his plans. That helps us understand why he's not rich toward God. So he's just sliced God out of the whole equation, hasn't he? Really has. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
One thing that stands out to me is that, well, some people come to Jesus or to John and say, what should I do? This man is saying, I want you to make this person do something. Yeah. And Jesus is addressing that. I'm not making someone else do what you want them to do. You need to fix yourself.
Right, right. Self-evaluation is what he needs most of all, not Jesus fixing his brother. Yeah, that's a great... Boy, look how much is in this. We could spend another 20 minutes on this. Almost, right? We probably could. That's just how deep these teachings are. So let's look at the next one as far as life lessons. This is a lot more involved here, but I think it's very similar. It's got a similar kind of tone to it in its poignancy. It's over in Luke 16. And this is not, I'm not totally wedded to this, but I am trying to lean toward some examples of some texts that we'll be reading in our congregational readings in the coming weeks. And these are. So look here in Luke 16. Let's start here with verses 14 to 18, first of all. Gary, can you read verses 14 to 18? And that sets up the story. It's about the Pharisees.
The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things, and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your heart. For what is exalted among men is of admonition in the sight of God. The law and the prophets were unto John. Since then, the good news of the kingdom of God is preached. And everyone forces his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one dot of the law to become valid. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery.
All right, thank you. You may be thinking that all of a sudden in verse 18, the topic has changed. Okay? A little different topic, but not the setting. And we'll see this when we look at what's after verse 18. So let's start here, first of all, with verses 14 to 18. He references the Pharisees. We're about to really go deep on the Pharisees on Wednesday night here, and coming up real soon, possibly even this Wednesday, probably this Wednesday. Pharisees were though that group that developed between the Old and the New Testament. They were greatly a group that were resisting the influence of the Greeks and the Romans. And they wanted to separate themselves. That's what the word Pharisee means in its origin. It's a separation. And they had gathered around the scribes who had claimed to be the true keepers of the law, but over the centuries had added to the law of Moses their oral traditions, so that their oral traditions were just as binding in their practice as was the law of God. And in many cases, their oral traditions had gutted some of the laws of Moses, like in the case of Corban, the money dedicated, to God versus helping out your parents, as talked about both in Matthew and Mark. And so basically, to keep the Pharisees' tradition, you were gutting the law of God about taking care of your parents. So the Pharisees were those who appeared to be the righteous of the righteous, but Jesus exposed them for having a false standard of righteousness. That's really, in essence, what they were about. Well, according to Luke's opening here in this section in verse 14, what was the characteristic about them that Luke identifies?
They were scoffing at Jesus.
They were, and in verse 14, what characteristic?
Lovers of money.
Now, Okay, how is this consistent? If these were very righteous, holy people, how did this idea of loving money fall into this? Well, it had to do with their theology. I'm going to lead you into this. Maybe you know this. The Pharisees thought that money represented what from God?
Blessing.
Okay. That is that has some truth to it. Anything you receive from God is a blessing.
Favor, maybe.
Okay. But a favor. So take that to the next step. If you think that all your possessions are blessings from God, which they are, but that if you have a lot of possessions, you're especially favored by God, then what if you're poor? What does that mean? You're disapproved by God. You're out of God's favor. They actually believed in what we call in modern times the health and wealth gospel. If you're wealthy and you're healthy, God favors you. If you're sick and you're poor, God doesn't favor you. Actually, in your poverty and sickness, God is doing something. He's punishing you for something bad you've done. This doctrine goes all the way back to Job, doesn't it? This is an old human doctrine that says, when good things happen to you, God is pleased with you. And when bad things happen to you, God is not pleased with you. And that still pops up. And the Pharisees were complete supporters of that doctrine. And the problem with that doctrine is, and what do you do with Joseph? What do you do with Job? What do you do with David? What do you do with Jeremiah? What do you do with the Apostle Paul? And most of all, what do you do with Jesus? Because all of those men, godly men, could be put in those categories. Suffering in the flesh, bad things happening to them, health things happening to them, having not a lot of resources and those kinds of things. And so this idea of lover of money, don't automatically think they were just, you know, materialistic, which they were, but it had to do with their theology, their belief about God, that God favors people by giving them abundance. And so when Jesus is healing all these people of sicknesses, and when Jesus is spending so much time with common, even poor people, that really rocked their boat. These are the people that should be shunned, not embraced. And so this whole thing, this whole section here is about their version of the world versus God's. In other words, they had an inverted view of things, value system. And at the end of verse 14, Luke records here in what Jesus is saying, how that this is the heart of the issue. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. Reminds us a little bit of 1 Corinthians 1, right? The foolishness of men, what is foolish to men is actually the wisdom of God. So it's that inversion. So this whole text is about inversion. Getting things reversed. Now, before really elaborating on this love of money, this theology of the love of money that is rooted in the belief that God favors the rich and curses the poor, that's where the story is going to end up. But before he does that, he's addressing these Pharisees in general. And he says here in verse 15 that basically man's judgment means what in verse 15? How valuable is man's judgment?
Not very good. He calls it detestable.
Right. Well, yeah. And he talks about those who justify yourselves before men. What good is it if other people justify you? How much is that worth?
Nothing.
Nothing. It's God who justifies. So, and the Pharisees had developed a system with the support of the scribes where they were determining who the good people were, who were justified, who were righteous people. It was their standard. It was their system. It was not God's. And this is when Jesus says the law and the prophets were until John, but now the kingdom of God is being preached and everyone forces his way into it. You see over and over who is a constant obstacle to Jesus' ministry. Who is the most common obstacle? What group?
Pharisees,
scribes and Pharisees. See, they're trying to block. See, they're supposed to be the keepers of the law. In actuality, they're trying to impede the fulfillment of the law and the prophets, which was the kingdom of heaven coming through the Messiah. So the very law they claimed to so honor was trying to be fulfilled in the ministry of Christ, and they were opposing it. Again, they got this whole thing inversed. They got it all backwards. And then divorce. That seemed to be arbitrary. Maybe. But what Jesus is teaching here is divorce is sinful. But as we look at what the Pharisees do, and you see a little bit of this debate in Matthew chapter 19, among the real strict rabbis, there were two schools about divorce. One had a very loose view that if your wife only went toward the wife, not toward the husband, if the wife displeased the husband in any way, like messing up a meal, he could divorce her. The other school said she had to have some immorality in her, most likely, committing adultery. But there were a lot of Pharisees that were looking for loopholes regarding getting out of their marriages. This is very common. And how does this fit into the context? The Pharisees had concocted their own system of justification. The Pharisees had developed their own system of saying who's righteous and who's not. And they're downplaying the importance of staying with your wife, and they're saying you're completely justified by dismissing your wife for this or for that. And that was not God's will. So basically, this whole little section here, after he says the Pharisees were lovers of money, and he develops this idea that what the Pharisees are teaching they think is justified and right, but that's not necessarily what's right with God and all that. All of this is about how the Pharisees had corrupted in their teaching the idea of righteousness and the idea of being right with God. And then he tells a story. This is a lesson from life, because this evidently is a real story. This really happened. Ray Conies, can you read it for us? Verses 19 to 31, please.
Now there was a certain rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, gaily living in splendor every day. And a certain poor man named Lazarus was laid at his gate, covered with sores, and longing to be fed with the crumbs which were falling from the rich man's table. Besides, even the dogs were coming and licking his sores. Now it came about that the poor man died, and he was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom. And the rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried out and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool off my tongue, for I am in agony in this flame. But Abraham said, Child, remember that during your life you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus bad things. But now he is being comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, there is a great chasm fixed, in order that those who wish to come over from here to you may not be able, and that none may cross over from there to us. And he said, Then I beg you, Father, that you send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment. But Abraham said, They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. But he said, No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said to them, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded if someone rises from the dead.
All right, thank you. First of all, understand the afterlife doctrine here that's found in this text. This is pre-resurrection. These men are depicted in Hades, which is the realm of the dead. Hades is not equal hell. That's a Greek term, Gehenna, which means eternal punishment. Culture confuses Hades and hell. Some religious people do, but they're two different realms. Hades is just the grave, the realm of the dead, where the souls go. And this is pre-resurrection. Jesus has not even died on the cross yet, let alone resurrect, ascend, and then come back in judgment. This is pre-judgment, pre-resurrection. But these two souls are receiving in the afterlife a fit experience regarding their conditions. Now, remember how the story of the rich farmer just tells the story about what he's saying, I'm going to build barns, I'll enjoy myself and all that. And then the way Jesus assesses the man shows he's not a godly man. He's not a man rich toward God. Let's look here at Lazarus and the rich man. Did the rich man go to torment because he was rich? We shouldn't conclude that. Did Lazarus go to the bosom of Abraham and enjoy peace and rest because he was poor? That's not the point. To say that would completely misunderstand everything else the Bible teaches about righteousness. So Abraham had abundance, but we understand Abraham's condition with God. He was a most godly, faithful man. So and plenty of poor people have been ungodly. Okay, that's not it. But he is teaching the point that what you think is the way things are, they're not necessarily that way. So think about that story about rich man and Lazarus, and it looks like the rich man was really rich, the way he's depicted here. He is like a one percenter. He is really rich, and Lazarus was just terrible condition, physically and financially and everything else, and then all that reversed in the afterlife. And the rich man is suffering, and Lazarus is at peace in Abraham's bosom. Think about that story in light of that opening, verse 14. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things and they ridiculed him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God." See, to the Pharisees, a man who's described as this rich man is, they would automatically conclude what about his state with God? The rich man. He's favored by God. He's in good with God. What would they conclude about Lazarus? Laid on the streets, got sores, dogs came up and licked him. He just wished for just the least little thing. He must be scum of the earth. And not just physically, but also spiritually, there's some contamination in this man. Yeah, Joe?
It seems like they knew each other because the rich man knew Lazarus.
Yes. 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 Right, right. Shows the heartlessness maybe of the rich man. Yes, it is in the story. So and that's part of the poignancy of this story is that the rich man was aware of Lazarus' suffering. And now he's aware of his suffering and Lazarus' comfort. Yeah, it's reversed. See, that whole thing is reversed. And the Pharisees would have judged these men on this side of the grave as Lazarus, the sinner, and the rich man, the godly man. But the way it ended up, it's clear the rich man was the ungodly man and Lazarus must have been a godly man because that's he ended up with Abraham, who was a godly man of faith. So look at this story is about inversion here and understand, I don't think this is a traditional parable. First of all, how many parables do you know where a person is named? Yeah, a farmer went out to, you know, a sower went out to sow. A woman was cleaning her house. A merchant went and found a pearl. They're hypotheticals, you see. They're common. They can really happen. They do really happen. This is actually a man named Lazarus. Isn't it interesting the rich man's not named? I think that indicates something. Sometimes a person's name is not listed in the Bible because it appears that God wants that person to be, who they are doesn't matter, okay? Like the widow who put in the two mites, and Jesus praises her and elevates her and uses her as an example. Her name's never mentioned. That's okay. That's not what matters about that woman. It's interesting how that Lazarus is named. Jesus knows his name. So a real person is named here, and this is just a straight up story about the afterlife. This is not some story about farming or vineyards or shepherding, and then there's a spiritual meaning in it. The spiritual meaning is clear here. It's not cloaked. One man was rich and people thought he was godly. One man was poor and sick. They thought he was ungodly. They died and God says, no, this is the man that's godly and this is the man that's not godly. It's just a straight up story. There's nothing cloaked here at all. So we've already identified some of those vivid elements. How does this story work as a teaching technique for Jesus to the Pharisees? And of course, Jesus was not just trying to convince the Pharisees of truth. He's trying, it appears, you see this in Matthew 23, he's trying to convince people who are in danger of being influenced by the Pharisees. He's trying to counter their influence. So why is this story so effective?
He's showing them that their entire theology is off.
From an eternal perspective, it's actually deceiving. What else would you say regarding why this is an effective story? Or use of a story? What does Jesus do here that any other teacher can't do? Jesus' story is based on what? Knowledge of what? The afterlife, where Lazarus ended up in the afterlife and where the rich man ended up. Only God sees that eternal picture. Zachary?
Interesting your point about Lazarus being named, so I was curious what the name Lazarus means.
Okay.
It means God has helped.
Okay.
And so your point about how they thought that God is favoring the rich and not favoring the poor, he chose to put the name God has helped on the poor man.
Right. Yeah, and I think the lesson's worth reminding ourselves, it's not that poverty makes you righteous and riches make you unrighteous. It's not the point. It's that the presence of riches does not automatically mean God's favor. And just like hardships, people say, what did I do wrong? I've somehow offended God because I got cancer or because my child is sick or I had a car accident, my wife got hurt really bad or something. What have I done against God? Maybe nothing. And so ultimately, God does help Lazarus in the end, doesn't he? Okay, thank you very much. We'll keep looking at samples of Jesus' teachings and marvel at them.